Pushing it. So we mentioned, right, Pasuk Mem, Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Mem. And we mentioned that Shlomo HaMelech wanted to kill Yerubam. And the simple pshat is, the way most Mepharshim learned, that he felt that Yerubam was he actually was right, that Yerubam was a Marid B'Malchus, Yerubam insulted the king. The Abarbanel adds that he had heard about the prophecy of Achia Shiloni, that he was destined to be the next king, who was going to take away a chedek of the Melucha from Shlomo's son. We pointed out that it could not mean that Shlomo thought that by killing Yerubam he could stop the prophecy from being fulfilled. He himself was given the same nevuah. So obviously, even if he killed Yerubam, it would still happen. But that rather it clouded his judgment. Since the din of Marav Malchus depends upon a subjective judgment, it's not an automatic death penalty, it's up to the king to decide. And perhaps Shlomo would have decided differently in view of perhaps the political consequences, in view of the good points of Yerubam, whatever it may be. But he may have decided differently had his judgment not been clouded to a certain extent by this animosity or this feeling that he's taking away the Melucha from my son. So we started a discussion as to how one deals with it. This is a fundamental concept in human nature, that we tend to judge things and make decisions that we think are rational, but they're really based on subjective biases. And it all depends on, as my partner, Rabbi Harris, is fond of saying, it all depends on which side of the table you're sitting on. I think I mentioned this story once before. I recall, this year, maybe it was last year, I don't remember when it happened. I got a phone call from the Menahel of one of our affiliated high schools about a certain student who was somewhat difficult, and the question was whether to allow him to come back for the following school year. And in the course of the conversation, he expressed some, resentment over the fact that the person who recommended the student in the first place did not reveal the entire story. But that unfortunately does happen. Anyway, after a long discussion, I sort of felt that although there were issues, it wasn't sufficient to simply tell him that he can't come back. But if you could find another school that's willing, a similar school that's willing to take him and give him a fresh start, then you're okay. If the parents don't want to take advantage of that, you're not obligated to keep them. But as long as you provide them with an alternative, I suggested a different high school, a different one of our affiliates that might be willing to take him. I happened to have known at the time that other high school had a similar student, so I thought they might work out a trade. But sometimes a kid needs a fresh start, a new location. It takes a while till he wears out his welcome. He'll make it through school. You know, you got to try to work it. So that, but I didn't tell him that. But that's what I thought. About 5 minutes later, he calls me back. He says, "When I speak to the school, do I have to tell them the whole story?" So I said, "Well, not unless you want him to be angry at you the same way you're angry at the other guy." But all of a sudden, you know, the situation changes. So how do you deal with that? So one answer we mentioned last time is Berov Eitz Sushia, Tshuva Berov Yoetz, is by speaking to people. When you make decisions, whenever practical, to talk to other people, perhaps don't have the same biases, or not to the same extent. So by getting other opinions, they sometimes could see things that you can't see, not necessarily because they're smarter than you, although it wouldn't hurt if they were, but not necessarily, but simply because they don't have the same biases in the Gius. And in fact, there are several Maimari Chazal that indicate that if two people reach the same decision independently, very often if they speak to each other, they will change their minds. And we find, for example, that Shimon and Levi wiped out the city of Shechem, and they were criticized by Chazal for not discussing it with each other. In a similar way, Nadav and Avihu, that brought the Esh Zara and were killed, were criticized for not discussing it with each other, even though they both independently reached the same decision, because when you discuss it with somebody else, he may have different biases than you have. He may have both reached the same decisions, but you'll see the fallacies of his argument, and he'll see the fallacies of your argument. And although you reach the same decision, perhaps for different reasons, in the end you could convince each other that you're both wrong. So even discussing with somebody with the same point of view sometimes produces different results. Certainly if you discuss with somebody who's not involved in the incident at all. A second thing we mentioned is what Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal referred to as pushing buttons, but what that really means is that if a person analyzes his own actions and questions his own decisions, very often you just recognize the truth. Because all these types of rationalizations take place at the upper level of consciousness. But deep down, a person usually knows that he's fooling himself. And therefore, when you address it, it's sort of the truth sort of speaks up. Or as the Rosh Yeshiva put it, the button lights. You press the button, the light goes on. You see that that is actually the truth. And I don't remember if I mentioned this last week, but if I didn't, I should have. Very often you'll see that a person who is deciding to take a certain course of action, sometimes another person goes, why don't you ask somebody? Why don't you ask the rabbi? Why don't you ask the posek? Why don't you ask an advisor? And they'll react by saying, oh, I don't need to ask. I know it's obvious. So this other fellow obviously didn't think it's so obvious. Why don't you need to ask? The answer isn't that you don't need to ask. The answer is because in your heart you know that if you ask, you might get an answer different than the one that you want. And therefore you're not willing to ask. So there is a certain recognition that that I'm fooling myself. So it is possible, again, none of these things are foolproof. There's no guarantee, it's a struggle. And sometimes it works, but this is one of the eitzes that could work. Another eitze that sometimes works, I call it depersonalization. If you take the situation you're faced with and imagine it happening to somebody else, or better yet, reverse it. Suppose you're dealing, Reuven is dealing with Shimon. Let Reuven imagine what would be if I was in Shimon's place and Shimon was in my place. Reverse the sides in the story. And let's analyze the case. Depersonalize it. Put it on somebody else. Often, a person is able to see through the rationalizations. And again, it's not perfect, and not foolproof, but it is an eitzah. Of course, the best form of that is when you're not even aware that it applies to you. But that takes another person. If you're ever trying to persuade somebody else that what he's doing is wrong, this is also a good strategy. Don't talk about him. Talk about a different situation, and then apply it to him. This is the eitzah that Nosan HaNavi used in talking to David HaMelech. Right? When David HaMelech sinned with Bathsheba, so Nosan comes in, and he gives him a whole story about two neighbors, one is rich and one is poor, and the poor person only has one sheep, and he's so close to that sheep, he sleeps in the house, it's a pet, and he goes through the whole thing, and then the rich person decides to steal the sheep and shecht it, and what would you say about such a person? And David HaMelech is very angry, he says, Ben Mavis, who, not that he's chayav misa, you're not chayav misa for stealing, but such an avla is worthy of death. So then Nosson says, Ata Ha'ish, you're the guy. Here you're the king, you have anything you want, and this one person he has is one, you have to go after her. You're the person, and he said, Chatasi. So that was the strategy that Nosson HaNavi used in David HaMelech. Let's understand something. The Medrash in Tehillim in Shochar Tov says that both David HaMelech sinned and Shaul HaMelech sinned. Yet Shaul HaMelech lost the Malucha and David HaMelech did not lose the Malucha. What was the difference? Really, the Gemara says this, but the Medrash adds certain nuances. What's the difference? Right. That David said Chatasi and Shaul did not. Shaul also said Chatasi, but only after two rounds of arguments. First he defended himself, then he defended himself again, and then he said Chatasi. David said Chatasi first time around. So what is the Gemara telling us? And the Gemara the Gemara says that Shaul was even greater than David. Shaul was actually a greater person than David overall. But in this area, the ability to acknowledge your error, to acknowledge your sin, David was greater than Shaul. So the great characteristic of David was that he was able to say Chatasi. He was able to recognize his own shortcomings. This is the outstanding midah of David HaMelech. This is what made him so special. This is what preserved the kingdom for him. This is what made him superior to Shaul. And yet, Nathan HaNavi couldn't come to him and just say, you did wrong. He had to give him the mashal first. Because even the greatest person who is the most adept at recognizing their own errors and shortcomings has a difficult time. But I've rationalized it, I've explained it, I've justified it. No, I haven't sinned. You're wrong. Nathan HaNavi, you're wrong. And of course, Nathan is coming with this mashal. You have to realize that Nathan just doesn't come and tell stories to David HaMelech every day. What would you say in this case? What would you say in that case? It's not like, you know, you're learning in yeshiva, you make up all these hypothetical cases. How would you pass in this case? How would you pass in that case? He must have realized that he had a message, but it still worked. But even David HaMelech, a frontal attack, would not have worked so well. So the idea is that by depersonalizing it, one has a little bit more of a chance. Yeah.
Why didn't Shmuel do those things right?
Good question. I don't know the answer, but okay. Then there's a fourth Eitzah that also has an ability to work. The name, there are probably others, but these are the ones I'm singling out. I have to save some for next time we come up with this topic. I call it raising stakes. Realizing what's at stake, realizing how important it is. One of the ways the Yetzer Hara sort of enables himself to slip by is to try to go under the radar screen. Not such a big deal, not so important, whatever it is, you know. And I have a reason, justification, you don't have to think twice. To give you a simple example, supposing somebody comes with you with an investment opportunity. And he tells you a whole story about how with this investment opportunity, if this falls into place, that falls into place, you can make double your money in 2 years. And he's asking for an investment of $100. So listen, the guy says I could double my money in 2 years, $100. Hey, listen, what's the big deal? Give it a try. But if he's asking for an investment of $100,000, you know, you're going to say, okay, what's your track record? How do you know what happened in previous investments? Who else is involved? You start getting a lot more questions. What's the matter? $100,000 is even better to double your money. The answer is because, you know, you hear these stories, you don't really believe you're going to double your money, but I'll give it a sweep for $100. You buy a lottery ticket for a dollar, you think you're going to win $105 million? Not if you're rational. But what if I do win $105? It's only a dollar. What's the big deal? Right, but if you had to put up $100,000 and you're going to win $1 billion, whatever it works out to, even though the possibility of gain is even greater, but so is the possibility of loss. The stakes are higher. Stakes are higher, you're more careful. So a person recognizes we're talking about Nitzchias, we're talking about eternity, we're talking about Torah. The stakes are high, even on what we would deem a mitzvah kala. Maybe it's not the biggest mitzvah in the world, but it's a mitzvah nonetheless. When you realize what's at stake, it's somewhat easier to see the truth. There's a phenomenal medrash that the Rosh Hashiva Zetzal was medayek on. The medrash says, and it's referring to the Meister Sheni, I'm sorry, I'm mixing my medrashim. The medrash is referring to the Tochacha Har Grizim Har Evo. And in the beginning of Parshas Re'eh. And the medrash says that the purpose of the bracha and the kola is l'man yilmad eze derech yelech ba, to teach you which way you should follow. So Rav Shiva was medayek and said, what do you mean to teach you? The purpose of a bracha and a klala is not to teach you, it's to motivate you. You already know what's right and what's wrong. And I'm telling you, if you do this, if all I want to do is to teach you, I don't have to give you a curse, I could just say, you know, you shouldn't take bribery to kill an innocent person. Nefesh dam naki. I don't have to give you a curse. I can just tell you what's right and what's wrong. So what does this have to do with teaching? The reason of a curse and a blessing is a motivation. I know what's right or wrong, but I don't really feel like doing it. So I tell you, listen, if you do the right thing, you get a bracha. If you do the wrong thing, you get a kala. So that'll motivate me to push myself to do something, even though I don't have this great desire to do it. But what does it have to do with teaching? So he explained that the Medrash is addressing, is referring to a person who has convinced himself that right is wrong and wrong is right. The same problem that we've been talking about. He's rationalized because of his various biases and the Gios. So you tell Arur Lokeach Shochad Larog Nefesh Damnaki, right? If you tell him Lo Sasa came without the curse, it's not going to do any good. He says, I know that's talking about a normal situation. But this case is different, because this guy is a no-goodnik, and this guy's a tzaddik. So of course, it's true in this particular case, he happens to be innocent by only giving him what he deserves. Because I'll already tell you this rationalization. Or a person, you know, you have a rich man and a poor man coming to a din Torah, so you'll say, really, the poor man is chayav, but this rich man is rich, and he should really be supporting the guy with tzedakah funds. But that's a little embarrassing for the guy to ask for tzedakah, so I'll rule against him. So I have a rationalization, I have a justification. The extent to which we could rationalize and justify ourselves is very interesting, because all, if you look at these brachas and kolos, some of them are pretty bad. To take bribery to kill an innocent person, or make re'eu basasa, to strike your friend in secret. Okay, chazal darshan refers to lashon hara, but the pashas akram means to kill somebody, to murder somebody without witnesses. So a person could justify that it's a mitzvah. Shochevim behema is a mitzvah. All these different things that a person could justify and rationalize. So what's the answer? I'm going to give you a blessing and a curse. So how does that help? Either there's a curse for a person who takes a bribe. That's if it's wrong, but this case it happens to be right. Right? Of course a person is cursed if he does this and that, but not me. Because I've justified it, I've rationalized it. But the answer is you've raised the stakes. Okay, you're right, but you're not investing $100. You're investing $100,000. You're investing $1,000,000. This is a big investment. You might be right. But just know what's at stake. If you're right, taka, you'll be zocha to a bracha. And if you're wrong, you're going to get a kolah. There's a lot at stake here. Oh, it's a big investment. Let me think this through again. And a person sometimes can see the truth, whereas otherwise he would have been blinded. So these are some of the eitzes that the Bali Musa teach to help overcome this weakness of human nature, a weakness that apparently even great people are subject to from time to time. Now, in this pasuk, we find that Yerubim escapes from Shlomo and goes to Mitzrayim. This is a familiar refrain already. We find the various enemies of Shlomo end up in Mitzrayim, although the whole downfall of Shlomo began with and revolved around marrying these princesses, particularly Bas Paro, in order to make allies of these foreign nations. And it turns out that they're harboring Shlomo's enemies. The king of Mitzrayim here is identified as Shishak. That is not the same name as we've been dealing with before. And many of the Mefarshim on the Pasuk learn that it was a different king. Shishak must have taken over the throne, probably in a coup, probably not the son of the previous king. So if the previous king was a big friend of Shlomo, the new king is going to be an enemy. And he is providing safe haven for all of Shlomo's enemies. So here, we see how all these plans that Shlomo had to outsmart history, so to speak, backfire. Mida k'neged mida. The Medrash actually says that Shishak was the same king. And this name Shishak is a symbolic name that we have very frequently in Tanakh, that the same individual is referred to by different names. And one name is the real name, the other name signifies something about his life or about the person. So this is what the Medrash in a number of locations says. And they darshan that Shishak comes from Lashon of Cheshek, of desire. And the two variations in the Medrashim, either he desired Shlomo's throne. You remember Shlomo built a magnificent ivory throne that had all kinds of amazing features. And Shishak wanted that throne, and eventually he actually captured it. 5 years into the reign of Rechavam, Shishak attacked Israel and plundered a number of items. Or some say just he wanted his wealth. Simple, plain gold, wasn't necessarily specifically interested in the throne. So what was Shishak's rationalization when he attacked? He said, my daughter was married to Shlomo. Shlomo died, she's entitled to a ksuva. So I'm collecting the ksuva on her behalf. And therefore that justified his plundering Eretz Yisrael. So according to that, it's even more ironic, more Mida Kenegan Mida. Here, Shlomo marries Bas Paro in order to create peace and a bond between them so as to prevent being attacked. And that itself was used as the very reason for making the attack. Right. The reason why Shishak attacked was because his daughter married Shlomo. So here Shlomo thinks, by marrying Bas Paro, he's going to prevent an attack. Not only does it not prevent the attack, according to the Medrash's version, it actually causes the attack. According to the Pashtunim, the Pashas of the Kra, it didn't cause the attack, but it didn't succeed very well in preventing it. And it turned out that Egypt, the country you tried to make allies of, turned out to be your enemy. So that's one dark of Mida Kenegan Mida. But the justification for the attack was good for the fact that you married his daughter. That's an even higher level, yes.
Did they have good intentions to try to make peace?
Some have good intentions, right, but it was wrong. Sometimes you have good intentions and it doesn't work out. So let's take a look at Pasuk Mem Aleph. The Yeser Divrei Shlomo and all the other words of Shlomo or things of Shlomo. The Chol Asher Asa, all that he did, the Chachmasa and his wisdom. Halohem Ksuvim, are they not written as Sefer Divrei Shlomo, the Sefer of the words or things pertaining to Shlomo HaMelech? Now the Targum translates it as words, Divrei as words, Pisgame. There is a machlokas as to what exactly this pasuk is referring to. One way of learning it would be, and that would really, Divrei means the davar, devarim shel, the things of Shlomo. Every king, we find this throughout Tanakh, every king kept a chronicle, Sefer Divrei Hayamim, which were a historical record of his kingdom. Of course, it was his version of the historical record of his kingdom. It's kind of like presidential memoirs. Right? Every president retires, writes his memoirs, and writes a book and gives his view of his presidency, which often differs from other people's view of his presidency. Usually it's a little bit more positive. That has something to do with the biases that we talked about beforehand. But so every king had a Sefer Divrei Yamim. So here too he says, the Navi is so to speak saying, we have taken things from the life of Shlomo, from the things that happened to him, which is ra'i to be included in Sefer Malachim, in the books of the Tanakh, because there are lessons to be learned l'dorei doros. But there are many other things that happened in Shlomo's reign, which are not as vital for future generations. But if you're interested, you could look it up. It's in the Sefer Divrei Yamim. We don't have that Sefer because it wasn't made part of Tanakh, and therefore it wasn't preserved. So we don't have those Sefers. So that's how the Metzudas learns others as well. The introduction of Chachmaso is a little bit out of place in such a context. Presumably, if you looked at the history of Shlomo, you would see evidence of his wisdom, but that isn't really what the book is all about. The book is a history book, things that happen. So, what? Possibly, but that's what we're getting there. So it really should have said, as you find by other kings, V'yeser Devarav, or you know, Sefer Halohim Ksuvim, Sefer Divrei Yamim. But why is it specifically Chachmaso? So one could answer that the Chachma is apparent in the way that he ran the government and all the decisions he made over the years. And, you know, Derech Agav, you see his Chachma as well. But this clue leads others to suggest that the Svarim that we're referring to here are not the historical chronicles that every king kept, but they are the Svarim of Chachma that Shlomo HaMelech wrote. And Shlomo HaMelech actually wrote three such Svarim. Right? Shir HaShirim, Mishlei, and Koheles. Incidentally, it just reminds me of something I was recently reminded of, that I once saw an article. I'm not sure if I should identify who wrote it, but he is a well-known, shall we say, apikoros. who wrote an article disputing that Shlomo wrote Koheles, and he said it was obvious that Koheles was written much, much later, about 200 or so years into the Bayis Sheni. He says, why? So his main proof was the fact that a number of the psukim and the ideas that are found in Koheles can be found in Greek philosophy. All the rivers run into the sea and the sea is never full. You know, and various other statements were found in Greek philosophy. And appeared, began to appear around 50 to 100 years into the Bayis Sheni. And it takes about 100 to 150 years typically for what he called cross-culturalization, for things to make it from one culture into another. And therefore, if the Greek stuff was 100 years into the Bayis Sheni, so then the earliest this Koheles could have written was 200 years in the Bayis Sheni. He seems to have neglected the possibility that perhaps the Greeks got it from the Jews. Now, if you figure it that way, the Greeks came into contact with the Jews about 100 to 150 years before this stuff started appearing in Greek literature. So it's so obvious, if it's in Greek literature and it's in Jewish literature, the Jews must have got it from the Greeks, that he actually thought this was a proof that Koheles was written later. Obviously, Koheles was written earlier, and when the Greeks came into contact with the Jews, they got it from the Jews, as they did many other things, which are clearly written earlier, and that found their way into Greek and Roman culture. So it's funny how you talk about biases. This was such an obvious proof to him, and it's actually funny. But, be that as it may, the three Sfarim that Shlomo HaMelech wrote were Mishlei, Shir Hashirim, and Koheles, and they contain the Chachma of Shlomo. So that would be another option. However, the question on that is that it doesn't say Sfarim, books, but rather Sefer. Al Sefer Divrei Shlomo. And if we're talking about the books that were written by Shlomo that display his Chachma, there were three of them. So I thought that it is possible to explain it according to at least one opinion in Chazal. There is a machlokas as to when these books were written. One opinion is that Shir Hashirim was written when Shlomo was young, and Mishlei was written when he was middle-aged, and Koheles was written when he was older. So there were three separate Sfarim written in three distinct periods of Shlomo's life. However, there is another opinion that all of them were written when Shlomo was older. And that it says the lashon was that he did tshuva, the nachsal of Ruach HaKodesh rested upon him, and he wrote all three Sfarim. According to that opinion, one could perhaps explain why Sefer is written singularly, because it really was one Sefer. It was all written at one time. We divide it up into three, because the three different themes, the sub-themes, but in a sense, it's three different chapters, if you will, the three different sections of the same Sefer. This was the culmination of Shlomo's career, where he put into writing the essence of all his wisdom and his Ruach HaKodesh, and it was written together. So it really, in a certain sense, was one Sefer, even though in Tanakh it counts as three Sefer. In Divrei HaYamim, in Divrei HaYamim, it says at this point that there were three Nevi'im that prophesied about Shlomo. There were Nasan HaNavi, Achya HaShiloni, and Ado Isha Elokim. Nasan HaNavi, we know, we're familiar with as the Navi who actually spoke to David HaMelech, but he was still alive when Shlomo became king, and he was the Navi of the early years of Shlomo. You might call it the glory years of Shlomo. Achya HaShiloni, as we know, prophesied in the later years of Shlomo. He was the one who gave the Nevuah to Yerubbaal. According to Chazal, he was the one who gave the Nevuah to Shlomo as well. And he was the Navi of Shlomo's downfall. Ado was really the Navi to Yerubbaal. But in his prophecies to Yerubbaal, he talked about Shlomo as well. So what Ado is the impact of Shlomo after his death. Shlomo's errors had impact even later, as we know, when the Melucha was torn. So we're coming to the conclusion of the segment, the history, the lessons of Shlomo HaMelech. We take a look at Pasuk Mem Beis. V'hayamim asher malach Shlomo b'Yerushalayim al kol Yisrael. And the days that Shlomo ruled in Yerushalayim on all the Jews, Arboim Shana, 40 years. It's interesting. This is not an accepted opinion. And any, you look in the back of any art scroll or wherever you want, there are all kinds of tables of the history of the different kings and the years and the chronology. And Shlomo's rule is counted as 40 years long. And that would certainly seem to be what this pasuk says. There is one opinion brought down in the Barbanel that Shlomo's rule was more than 40 years long. Because this pasuk says he ruled for 40 years in Yerushalayim al kol Yisrael. Why is that added? We know that he was in Yerushalayim. David HaMelech already moved into Yerushalayim. We know he ruled al kol Yisrael. Right? The kingdom wasn't divided until the days of Rechavam. So why does the pasuk say Yerushalayim al kol Yisrael? So this interpretation says it means it's referring again to the glory years. If you remember, we mentioned Mefarshim that said although the kingdom was not taken away from Shlomo until after the death, but he wasn't having the same type of prestige and power. He already had trouble with the various enemies, the Satan from Edom and from Aram. So he had all these difficulties. So the 40 years that he ruled in his glory, Yerushalayim al kol Yisrael, without any problems. And then there were additional years, we don't know how many, according to this, which he ruled with difficulties. It wasn't so simple. Of course, according to this, it's really very perplexing because then all the charts get thrown up. We have no idea anymore how long, how you account for everything. So, and all the calculation, the number of years that Kaisa was in Eretz Yisrael, and the number of years the Beis HaMikdash survived, anything else would be thrown off by these calculations. But we don't have to worry too much about it because basically everybody else, including the Barbanel himself, disagrees with this opinion. And all 40 years means 40 years, some of which we're talking not in peace and tranquility. How many we don't know? Yes.
Excuse me, Rabbi. We know the Shlomo HaMelech for 7 years. He wasn't actually the king.
You're thinking of David HaMelech.
Shlomo HaMelech, because
you mean when he was away? You mean?
Yes, he goes away because he lost the kingdom.
Well, of course, that's some opinions correct. But is that included in the 40 years, you mean?
Yes, that's what I mean.
I don't know. I assume yes. The 40 years means 40 years from the beginning of his rule till the end of his rule. Okay. So let's a little of the more mainstream explanation. So the question is a good question. Why does the pasuk say, Yerushalayim al kol Yisrael? So the Malbim says that the point of this pasuk was to contrast his melucha to David's melucha. David, this is what I thought you referred to at first. David, for the first 7 years of his melucha, his capital was in Hebron, and he only ruled over Yehuda. So although David also ruled for 40 years, but Shlomo's melucha was greater than David's melucha because he was B'Yushalayim HaKol Yisrael. Not that Shlomo was greater than David, his melucha was greater, that was because of what David did. But he had a more powerful kingdom. Another pshat, this is the Bar Avinel's own opinion, is that this is to be Meshabeach, to praise the power of Shlomo HaMelech. Today, it's almost a natural course of affairs of any significant world leader travels. Right? You travel all over the world. The president goes to Europe, and he goes to Asia, and he goes to wherever. Right now, the presidential candidates have to travel as well. So that's what it means to be a world leader. Certainly within your own country, you travel. Could you imagine what would happen to a president of the United States if he became president and never left Washington, D.C. for the 4 years of his rule? For sure he wouldn't be reelected.
But
that's dangerous. But I'm not so sure. He would not be able to exert the control over the country that you do by going around. That's why they travel. You have to meet people, you have to talk, they have to meet officials. So for a king to stay in his headquarters and still exert complete authority and control over the entire country is not so simple. Especially in those days, without the kind of communication that we have today. You could pick up the telephone, you could text message, you could email, you could have virtual, web conferences. Right? Your face shows up on the screen, you could go face-to-face meetings all over the world. There's a lot of things one could do to exert one's influence in faraway places. And yet, somehow, people travel. Right? People are doing business, they could get on the phone, they could do the email thing, they could do the web camera thing, and yet they have to travel and meet face-to-face and get things done. There's something about it, a face-to-face meeting, that exerts control and influence. But Shlomo had such power, at least in his prime, and such control, that he was able to be a melech b'Yerushalayim al kol Yisrael. He could sit home in Yerushalayim. He had a little bit of a high-tech way of communication too. We learned the Medrash that he had these trained birds, like the forerunners to carrier pigeons, right? And he was able to send messages throughout the country. He was actually able to travel if he wanted. And not that Shlomo didn't travel. I mean, the Bible is not saying he didn't travel, but he didn't need to travel. He was able to exert his influence, I'll call Yisrael, sitting at home in Yerushalayim, because there was such awe and reverence of Shlomo HaMelech in his prime that it wasn't necessary for him to travel, something that is not generally duplicated. Yes?
We know that before Melech Bekipa, Shlomo was one of them. Is it a reference here that he was al kol Yisrael but not on the rest of the world?
I don't know. I didn't see anybody comment on that. We did have that in an earlier pasuk, that there were different stages of Shlomo's rule. And one was on the whole world, and then on the surrounding countries, and then only on Kal Yisrael. But I didn't see anybody make a reference to that in this pasuk.
Is that the only opinion, that they're taking the pasuk literally, as opposed to where David's Mulcha was in two different places in the city, and
Right, that would be the Malbim section.
That it was split up.
Right.
In Yerushalayim was one place, and
but that's through Malbim's explanation that he, unlike David, he had one. He was always in Yerushalayim and always al kol Yisrael.
But was he literally always in Yerushalayim? That's the question.
I'm sure he traveled. He wasn't in prison there, but his kingdom, the seat of his kingdom, was in Yerushalayim. Pasuk Mem Gimel. We started late, so we go drop late. But I want to finish the parak. Today we can't make a siyum, so. It's a cheap way to finish the parak. So Pasuk Mem Gimel. Vayishkav Shlomo im avosav, and Shlomo was laid to rest with his fathers. Vayikover b'ir David, and he was buried near David. Vayimloch Rechavim b'no tachtov, and Rechavim his son ruled instead of him, in place of him. We find the expression "Vayishkav Shlomo im avosav." That phrase is reserved for a person who is a tzaddik, who belongs with his forefathers. So this is again another indication that Shlomo was really a tzaddik. Either he did tshuva or he never really sinned to begin with. We also find that that this expression, it doesn't say Vayamos, and we know from Chazal that the expression Vayamos is used when a person doesn't leave over a worthy successor to fill his place. But when you leave over a worthy successor, it doesn't say Vayamos. It says Vayishka Mevosov, Vayigva, Vayikaver, but it doesn't say Vayamos. So from here we get a little bit of a glimpse into Rechavim. Rechavim is a very interesting personality as well. We'll have to do more on Rechavim, obviously, beginning the next parak. But despite the fact that in the end Rechavim was not listed as one of the good kings, he had a lot going for him. He should not be so dismissed so readily. And he was criticized as being a Rasha to a certain degree, but he was not nearly as big a Rasha as Yeravam was. And for a number of years, he was actually a very big tzaddik. And one of his greatest acts of tzidkus was when the kingdom was divided. He had the military capability of squelching the rebellion. He gathered together a huge army, And according to normal military rules, of course, the Kadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, not military. But he could have defeated Yerubbaal and his followers and regained control of the kingdom. And he was given a message from a prophet that Kadosh Baruch Hu wants it to be this way. And he withdrew. He did not attack. So he did not fight the division of the Melucha because he accepted the Nevuah of Hashem. So Rechavim was not a small person. And he was actually a Yimloch Tachta, a replacement of Shlomo HaMelech. But as we go along in the next program, we will see that he also did have his downfall and did not maintain the standard that he started off with. Okay, we'll stop here for now.
Okay.